now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
We had a record snowfall up at Shaver to enjoy sledding. Did you?
You got there after the snowfall, though.
I know, which was great.
It's great to miss the snowfall.
Didn't have to shuffle, didn't have to do anything. Just enjoyed what was laid out there like manna. It was beautiful.
2 feet? Is that a record?
I think so. It was a short time because
before
a little
Christmas.
Before then, it didn't have a whole lot. And they got a massive dump.
Yeah, they don't often get snow before
we
Christmas.
We brought Groover slides, and my kids went off a monster jump. And the only safety thing was going right into the lake, which is be cold. And so they had to find a way to stop. It was hilarious.
I don't even know what a groover or what is. Slide? I don't know what that is.
It's a sled.
Sled.
It had grooves in it, and so it goes super fast.
Dad.
My kids really wanted them. I said, I think these are going to be fast. Like, oh, Dad, let's get those. And they came back to me, Dad, these are a little too fast.
A little wide-eyed look.
Yeah, I thought it was like, oh, that's great.
Hey, I thought about you guys when I saw that picture in the paper of that guy that's fallen off that ski lift and his pants got hung up on the thing and he's thinking about.
That doesn't bring up good memories, but.
It probably doesn't for you.
My son Jonathan survived a 40-foot fall up in Vail a number of years back.
Yeah, we had a great time hanging out with our kids. And, I mean, the girls are still pretty small to enjoy the snow fully, and I'm too old to, get out there and do a whole lot anymore. But we had fun. We had a great time.
And we just had a nice time with our extended family and just focused on caring for people. I don't think they're going to listen to this. So.
You might be safe.
I'm treading in dangerous there, but I think I'm fine.
Okay.
The reality is I recognized when there was misbehavior, because we got a whole mess of kids when we get together. And so it can, especially in the early years, it was not fun. It was endured.
In a pretty small cabin, too.
Oh, yeah. You don't have enough space there. But this time it was better, but you could just recognize all the arguing, the misbehaving at the end of the day. It was so hilarious. Kelly was reading, because she's a preschool teacher, and so she's going through all these, early school dynamics and stuff like that. And she's reading this statement, where in the world do we ever get the idea that somehow making a kid feel worse than he already does about what he's done is going to make him behave better? She asked me that question. And what was so hilarious in this moment is I instantly responded, church.
Oh, great.
Nobody said they're going, religion has taught us, as opposed to finding the source of what's hurting and ministering to that, we tend to respond in ways that just further exacerbate the situation. And we both had a hilarious laugh, but she looked at me going like, that came out rather quick.
I would assume so.
But it was, I sat there going, that is unfortunately where we've picked up a lot of that sense, where you're just going like, a true healing of a heart that's hurting isn't achieved by a list of behaviors you should be doing. It's never worked.
And pushing it does work temporarily. People will act better for a limited period of time.
If they're sufficiently scared.
Yeah, and I'm good at the scaring thing.
Okay. but the reality is I think it leads to a further dysfunction because
you
haven't captured the heart. So I don't think even if you've got the outward behavior.
Yeah.
That's why I look at all of Jesus' comments in the Gospels, and he was always, you've heard it said, but I say unto you, and he always took it a level deeper into the issues of the heart.
Yeah, well, you'll love this then.
Okay.
This is a letter. It's not about really our podcast so much, but a guy that's been writing me, and he says this, most of the people I know who've read some of your recent books somehow seem to not make it from the point of knowing how God is to being led by the Spirit simply because they listen to the subtle, dominant, capturing ideas of the flesh like they watch television, play computer games, and so to still the hunger of the soul, which wants to make their time in life fruitless and depressive, because they do not wait until God gives them love to do something. But they let themselves be led by lust, selfishness, which is bad food for the soul, which brings bad fruit earlier or later. And what his point was, you talk too much about God's love. You need to talk more about God's severity.
Because that was his point.
That was his point. And he answered, you know, man does not live by bread alone, but every word that comes from God's mouth, which is a great scripture.
Hold on for a sec. Didn't he write, because they're not waiting for God to produce a sense of love inside? Didn't you read that?
I did read something like that.
So lust is wrong and greed's wrong and all this I want to, the advertising, the games, but somehow the severity of God is going to go get them.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking that's true.
No, I think that plays into your point exactly. And I tried to write back and say, well, hold it a minute. First of all, I don't know. Most people I know reading my stuff are on a wonderful journey with God. If there are people out there using it to excuse themselves while they play video games and watch TV.
Video games, they're terrible and wrong.
That's his point was, even the scripture, man does not live by bread alone. And I wrote back and said, but he does need some bread now and then. It's not the only thing he lived by. And the slapback was, I'm surprised you had TV to bread. And, again, I think these ascetic kinds of mentality, which is, if you're really following God, you won't watch TV, you will not play a computer game, and you won't, and I just go,
welcome to the dour sour hour.
Can you do so much of that stuff that you cried God out of your life? Well, absolutely, anybody could do that, but that's not really the point, is it?
Well, no, when you even look at the invitation to the Sabbath, let's just get to some rule keeping, all right?
Yeah?
The invitation to the Sabbath. What was it for? Was it God's really taking issue? You will not do any work. Or is it you're supposed to set some time aside to recognize rest and enjoy. Celebrate that life flows from there.
Yeah.
Not, I'm going to work until I'm exhausted and then finally rest. It's more like, why don't you begin life?
The Sabbath was really, in God's heart, like, take a vacation.
Yeah.
Don't work 7 days a week. Right. I don't need it. I don't want it. Take a break.
Yeah.
And we turned it into
a rule.
You have to take a break.
Yeah.
Or God's going to whack
How
you.
How dare you do that work, you dirty rotten. And it's like,
and wasn't that the attitude that faced Jesus? If he healed somebody on the Sabbath, or if they picked some grains in the field on the Sabbath? And
I know. Stepping outside of that structure, end up just going like, my gosh, how ridiculous is this?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to relieve this person of their lifelong ailment, not on the Sabbath.
Yeah, please.
You know, how dare you?
Yeah.
And he's going like, oh my gosh, how could the rules loom so large and the life become so little?
And anytime you lose compassion as the heart of what even God introducing the Sabbath, compassion. Not another rule to catch you in violating. When we're loving other people, once you remove compassion out of your dealings with people and you want to deal with them just as rules to be enforced, people to conform to your will, whatever, that's where all this goes sideways, isn't it?
It does. Do you ever remember seeing that movie First Night?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Sean Connery and Richard Gere in it.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, that was one of my favorite movies. And that has spoke volumes to me for a number of years as far as some of the lessons in there. But one of the most interesting things is, here's King Arthur, you know, Sean Connery, and they got this beautiful dream of a round table and a sort of a fellowship of brothers in this whole deal where it's like, you know, it's not about hierarchy. It is about relationship. It's like so many of the things that are in this wonderful little book. They're born out in this movie, and then there's Lancelot ends up becoming romantically involved with the future wife of the king. And it's a total betrayal, and it's a total deep hurt. And the king responds with a sense of, we will have justice, and he brings the law. And here's the laws of Camelot. Here's what we put out. And in that moment, that's when the enemy is able to get his way into the castle and take over the place. And destroys it. And I just sat there going like, I don't have any idea what was meant by the movie.
Yeah.
But I sat there and I realized, gosh, when we stop dealing with people and hearts,
yeah,
and we just start dealing with law and rules and this, that, the other, we do really open ourselves and become vulnerable to the enemy, who's the master legalist.
Yeah, isn't that the whole essence of the fall? We trade relationship and love for rules and manipulation and somehow pushing people to what we think they should do.
Enforcing what wasn't in their heart.
Yeah.
And it's like...
And not like we said about healing. Healing, Jesus always took it back to the heart. It's going to begin right there where you are. And you know what? If your life is so empty in Jesus that you play computer games 24 hours a day, you don't fix that by stopping playing the computer games. You don't. You fix it by finding out who he is and coming to the end of all of that. And the prodigal father who says to the son, you want to go? Go. Go to the end of all of that you think has life in it. And when you find out it doesn't, I'll be here for you. That's just a great statement of love.
Yeah, absolutely. I might just look at even just the silly little thing of, oh, video games, oh, they're terrible. It's like, you want to know what? There's no way on the planet my children who've grown up in the computer age, you make that a negative to them, they're going to look at you like, what?
Yeah.
That's somehow going to the mailbox is wrong. They're like, what?
Well, part of that heart is anything that's not God is carnal.
You were about to say fun. I saw you. You almost put the word fun there. And I know you didn't say it, but I'm just saying, I think there is some of that mentality.
Oh, I do.
If there's something that's fun or entertaining, oh, that's wrong.
Unless God is the focus
of it.
Yeah.
And God's always serious.
And why isn't God, who made us for recreation, who we most rest and renew in times of taking a break from the things that drive our days? Why? I mean, the whole mentality of that just is beyond me. You don't play a computer game? Hey, play a computer game. Enjoy yourself. You watch a football game on TV? Just talking about television. I said, are you talking about R-rated stuff? I mean, are you talking about, like, really? Well, no, I'm just talking about
stuff. If the Bible was made literally into a movie and picture, it would be R-rated.
Or X.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just kind of like, excuse me, there's a couple of those Old Testament ones where you got some guy putting a spear through a couple that's in a tent. And you're going like, how would you show that?
How about Noah's daughter-in-law? There's another story. You know, probably one of the best letters I've ever got. I want to read this to you. We talked a couple of podcasts ago. I don't remember when, really. We talked about this left-handed, right-handed power thing. This is after I got back from Arizona.
Yeah.
I met a guy this fall. I asked if I could read his thing on the podcast. I met a guy this fall when I was traveling in Virginia that is left-handed because he was born without a right arm. He's never had a right arm.
It's sort of by default.
Yeah, and it's and in that context, and it's always been a hurtful place. Why was I born without an arm? It's a place kids teased him about at school. It's things people sometimes minimize because he's a handyman. I tell you, I watch him do things with one arm that most guys can't do with two. I mean,
he's a handyman.
But he listened to the podcast about left-handedness, and he wrote this.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is incredible.
I'm all ears.
Hey, Wayne, what a flurry of life splashed all over me when you brought up the right-handed power versus the left-handed power in the podcast. Father's unfolding another level of his love to me. Born without a right arm, forced into left-handedness, forced to get by with something other or less than normal. And I've had these thoughts. I would not have chosen left-handedness. I would have preferred to have right-handed power. Rarely would anyone choose left-handedness. Left-handed power is perceived as weakness. It's slow. It's ineffective. It's indirect. It's unfruitful. Jesus always chose to wield left-handed power. He could have had legions of angels enforce what he wanted. When I say I miss my arm, I'm saying I miss my right to be right-handed. I miss my right hand every day. Father made me a left-hander. Deep stuff, this. That's what he writes. Isn't that good? This left-handed way relates directly to the question about how do we raise our children if we don't go to church, that you may address in the future. As religious parents, we usually try to force our kids to have a relationship with God. This is exactly what we're talking about. Church attendance is our right-handed way of controlling our children's directions. Right-handed power is related to fear, and we think God is right-handed. I know. I read that. You know what I thought of? People are going to send me scriptures. I know them in the Old Testament where it says,
"Son of my right hand."
God
yeah,
will defend you by my right hand. I know we're going to get that. But they're missing this point. Wayne, it's amazing to me how each podcast is so timely in my life. Thank you, dear brother. Your message, friendship, your life is giving to me this year.
Absolutely.
I'm feeling the warmth of Father's affection. And may the new year hold the ever deeper and sweeter love of Jesus, our left-handed Emmanuel.
That's his name? No.
Jesus is our left-handed man. His name's Robert.
Okay.
What?
Delightful.
When I read this, we've got a man in our life. Sarah and I celebrated him this morning. As a matter of fact, we're reading through John 1, and there's that point where Jesus meets Nathanael, and he just looks at Nathanael and he says, in the King Jimmy, I think, here is a man in whom there's no guile. It means there's just no deceptive place. There's no broken place. He is exactly what he presents himself to be. And every time I read that passage for the last 23, 4, 5 years, I don't remember how long ago I met Dave Coleman, the guy who helped me write the Jake book. I met Dave one time. I was pastoring in this fellowship, and you know, we had a whole smattering of people there. And somebody, I don't know if he introduced himself or someone introduced him. I seem to remember if somebody introduced him, but I don't know who that would be. And when I shook his hand, I looked in his eye. That's the phrase that ran through my heart. Here is a man in whom there's no guile. And I told him this. Because I said, I've got 22 years of friendship now with this man.
Wow.
We've been through hell together. We've been through some tough, tough straits in his life, some in mine. And I told Sarah this morning, you can count on one hand the number of people that I've met and prove over time to really be someone in whom there is no guile. There's nothing he's fighting for. And I think what defines that for me, here's a man with whom I've lived in a friendship for lo these many years, and he's had a very difficult journey in that, as have I in places. And Dave has never been other than himself.
Wow.
He's never used right-handed power. We've got some ventures together, including the book. Never once exploited that in any way. He lives in, and I told Sarah this morning, there's so precious few of those who over time demonstrate that, in fact, I am simply who I say I am.
Yeah.
And no wonder Jesus, and I think Jesus, I think the very fact that he says it about Nathanael is Jesus recognizing.
That's unique.
You don't meet this every day. In fact, I don't recall anywhere else in the Gospels where he actually says.
There's one.
Because there's a little guiling going on with Peter. There's a little guiling going on with James and John.
My gosh, there's guiling and beguiling everywhere.
There's a little guiling going on with Judas. I mean, there's all that stuff going on. And yet here, and that's, when I read this from Robert, what touched my soul. I looked at this saying, I'm not forced into left-handedness. I have a lot of right-handed stuff I can do. Our culture provides for our relationships, almost all of them.
Everything's right-handed power.
You've got to protect everything with right-handed power. And to think, here's a brother who never got to choose right-handed. I mean, still, he can act out in fleshy, selfish ways. He's not saying that. But what I thought was so beautiful is seeing now in the way he was made,
a gracious gift.
That God was speaking something to him out of our podcast about the graciousness of living left-handed, about the graciousness of not having at our disposal and not using every weapon we have to hurt the people around us or to get what we want. And I sat there with Sarah this morning, and we only celebrated Dave's life. I mean, our relationship has a lot of that in it, though. I've not known you that long.
We got about 8 years. That's infancy, man.
8 years in, and we're into some stuff now that we can either kill each other or not in terms of being in business now, something I said I would never do with anybody else after finding it not to be always fruitful and always work out well. But and I do have other friends that I would put in that same category as well. And they are really, 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 really a gift.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think I have the expectation of any in my life. I have the longing for that. There's one thing that the Lord, this is just Brad's little personal. I felt like God said at one point, I want you to gather a tribe of dead men. And I didn't really understood what, I didn't know what that meant. That has come to have deep meaning for me.
Hmm.
And what that means is people who are, they're dead to selfish ambition. That doesn't fuel their fire. I'm not out here to do my deal.
Yeah.
But they're passionately alive to the King and his call in their life and their desire to serve and be a part of that. And it's like there's so few that, frankly, I've met. I mean, for the longest time, this is going on about a decade that God has said this. And at times I've sort of despaired, just going like, Lord, one, I don't even know that I qualify.
I'm one of those.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've never sort of assumed, okay, well, that's my endorsement. It's no, I aspire. But where, I mean, that you're talking a deep work that doesn't happen with somebody's hand on your head. This isn't a moment. This isn't an event. This is like in the course of life, somehow God brings you to a glorious end of yourself. You know, when he says, you know, if you seek to save your own life, you're going to lose it. If you seek to find me, you know, it's like you just go like, gosh, Lord, I don't know the whole instincts of self-preservation. That's all right-handed.
Yeah.
The ingrained sense of, oh, my rights. And it's like
the first letter I read, that's what he was saying about the severity of God. He's saying, you guys don't talk enough about dying to the flesh. And I said, you know, I beg to differ with you.
Oh, gosh, yeah, the flesh is the kill it.
I don't talk about it as self-immolation because
right.
I don't think he's saying
you can do that.
Take up your cross and deny yourself and follow me. He's saying it to guys that don't have a clue what it means. Peter and James and John aren't hearing that going, oh, okay, we're going to die to that today. I think the reality of the New Covenant, is love wins us to that place. I think people who learn yeah. to live loved no longer have to fight for themselves. I think that's the reality.
Yeah.
The reality is when I hold my agenda before God every day, my agenda looks as stupid as it really is.
So, yeah, it does.
So laying it down is not, oh God, I'm going to give you all my desires and everything I've ever wanted. I'm going to give it all to you. And it isn't that. It's like, ew.
Please take this.
I mean, you're kind of hanging out with them going, I'm thinking this. And then as soon as you say it, you're going, okay, I know that sounds dumb. And I think the dying to self and, you know, whoever gets through this process, I just think it's a process. I'm still in the middle of it.
I think it doesn't happen in a way that you're finished. I think that is that daily reality that just says, you know what? If I had, quote, died to self last week, I could resurrect that little puppy today and go down the wrong road. You just go like, you know, there's a way of living where it's like, if I'm living knowing that I'm loved, then I don't have to take my right hand role.
Yeah.
I can really trust that, you know what, God, somewhere in all this, you're going to direct me.
Yeah.
It's not a life of passive acceptance.
Yeah.
It's a life of attentive, I don't have to serve myself. And that takes a lot of courage, especially when it doesn't look like the people around you are hearing the same thing.
Well, it's, when other people use right-handed power, and when all your cheerleading squad encourages you to use it too, that's where it's really tough.
Yeah.
It really is, because you get to the point of saying, and I think this is as probably ungodly a thought as we get, but you got to defend your rights here. You've got to defend what's yours. And I just, you know, if you're trying to break into my home and steal my family, I am going to use a little right-hand power. I got news for you. I don't know. That's where Jesus was really talking about, if your enemy asks for your furniture, give him your children too. I don't think that's what that means. So I don't think we're sitting here saying right-handed power is a horrible evil and that God never uses it, because there's some definite inferences in Scripture where that is going to happen. But I think what we're saying is relationships grow inside this left-handed reality of power, which is, how do I love and serve and care? Not how do I compel?
Yeah.
And I think his point about, you know, raising our children, that a church attend, and I hear this, I probably get this letter 3 or 4 times a week. What do I do with my kids if we're not going to church on Sunday morning? What's going to keep them whole? What's going to, and it's, you hear all the fear. The fear is my kids have nothing if they don't go to Sunday school. And you know what? What's probably sad is that may be true. Because
I don't think it's true. They may not have memorized Bible verses, but they're living with you day in, day out. You are educating them whether you realize it or
right.
not.
But if parents are not sharing their spiritual journeys with their kids, see, that's what I think is real important here.
Yeah.
If you're not sharing the spiritual journey with your child, if they're only getting that from memory verses in Sunday school,
but in the lack of proactively doing it, you are already educating.
I got to confess something here.
Okay,
I really, Sarah and I, we're moving in the next couple of weeks, so we're going through everything, files and all that kind of stuff. And we pulled out some old curriculum that I had helped write for a children's program when I was a pastor at church.
Oh, I bet that was enlightening.
Honestly, I didn't look through most of it. I really just tossed it, but I did see one of those charts we printed out. Memory verse, Bible reading, bring a friend, stars on the chart. I looked at Sarah. Wow, how far we've come. This seems so real and right at some season in our life. We didn't do that to defraud people. You know, it just seemed like that's what you do. But, man, I looked at that going,
manipulators. Yeah.
Wow, there's that all that right-handed power. We're going to make our kids conform. And then the reality is most kids grow up, leave their parents' faith when they leave their parents' home because they weren't engaged. We started this whole thing out. If it's just a conformity of behavior externally and you haven't won the heart, it will not endure past your fear. And your fear won't last forever.
It was funny. I was up late, and I think I just the TV was on as background noise, and I think it was something. I forget who. I think it was Jimmy Kimmel or something like that. But they're going
what?
Over.
They were, no wonder you have no life with Jesus. Okay, you're watching TV.
I know. And they were going through some sort of traditions or something like kids' responses to the holidays and stuff like that. And I wish I could remember the exact question that it was. But the answer was, you know, in regards to things that you don't like or the traditions you wish would be done away with, one of the kids' little response, and it was a cute little kid, and it was saying, I just don't like going to church. And I looked at that, and I sat there going like, gosh, you know what? You could have a response that just says, oh, how tragic. And I think what the kid is saying has nothing to do with spirituality and whether there's a God.
Yeah.
It's the sense of I've been given a meaningless form, a dead tradition that I don't find life-giving, and I'm told it's good for me.
Yeah.
And you just go like, I don't know that it is, kid. I think ripping through the wrapping paper of that gift that was actually meant with love to cause probably has more value in the exercise than the discipline of sitting through a supposedly good for you thing. I mean, our kids, Jared did go to Sunday school. Jonathan remembers a little bit of it. Taylor has never. And she visits every now and then friends of ours that go. And what's hilarious is we got a note in the mail from the Sunday school teacher who was absolutely blown away by Taylor because of just the way that she was. This is not someone who knows the right things to do.
Right.
This is just the genuineness of a little heart that was in that meeting. And her response was, you know, we said, well, did you like it? It was kind of boring, but I did draw a neat picture.
Tradition is French for bored. Michelle wrote us after we did that on a previous podcast, and she said, I laughed when you mentioned traditions on the podcast. On Christmas Eve, the grandkids were begging to open presents after dinner. My daughter-in-law always has my husband, their grandpa, read the Christmas story from the Bible before any presents can be opened. They aren't really into that, to say the least. As they are wanting to see what those packages contain. And I heard her in the next room tell the kids, if I had to do this for 15 years, you're going to do it too. And Michelle said, we all cracked up. We are funny creatures, aren't we? Mom's having them do it, not because she loves it, but because misery loves company. I've sat through it for 15 years. You're only six, doggone it. I laughed. I thought, man, that is how that tradition works.
Yeah, we've had a little tradition in our family of having like a little, it's like a Playmobil kind of little nativity scene. And ultimately, the little baby Jesus is one of the gifts under the tree. And that's just been a fun, because it's like you pile through all the gifts, and then finally you realize we open the last little gift that's unnamed, and we don't know who it's for, and we purposely kind of put it in there in the pile, so it's like, well,
everyone
it
must
is?
Know by now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the first year is like, what is
oh,
this?
Oh, here's a Jesus package.
But every other year, everyone's like, oh, and the kids' excitement
great idea.
Is at the end of the day, opening the little Jesus gift, where like, this is the real gift.
That's pretty cool.
This is what that's all about. Well, this year, everything went sideways. Last minute, the Christmas Eve, I get a fake Christmas tree. I'm serious. We moved, and it's like life is just life has never settled, and it's been just a tumult of other stuff. And the kids knew that, you know, this it was hilarious. So we're not doing the little traditions. We're sitting around the table, and I finally just look at the kids and said, "Hey, why don't this year you guys tell me, you guys do Christmas? What's this about?" And it was so fun to listen to the genuineness of what's in their heart, that wasn't tied. We didn't do any of the traditions. And Kelly and I just looked at each other with kind of satisfied looks, going, you know what? They're getting this. They know what it matters. They know the little stories. They know they enjoy some of the little traditions around it.
Yep.
But the reality of it is in their heart. It didn't need any of the trappings to be real.
Yeah.
And I just sat there going like, gosh, as odd a year that this is, it really was special as far as a sense of, you know what, this perhaps better than any other Christmas was centered on the real gift is us to each other.
But you're a pastor. You know how to do those things. People who are saying, I don't know how to help my kids. What would you say to parents? Because we get that email every week. Help us. What do we do with our kids when we're no longer in Sunday schools?
You know what? One of the most
we say
helpful,
share the journey, but
one of the most helpful things you ever did is you took discipleship as a program and stomped on it, in my understanding.
I did that?
You did that. Yeah, one time at lunch.
So.
Yeah, several years back.
I'm not thinking so.
Yeah, you did.
I don't know.
Well, at least it had that effect. And it reframed it to not lessons I must teach, but how do I perceive the things that are happening in my life, and how do I process them with this guy Jesus? What is the Holy Spirit doing at work? What is he using in my life to instruct me? As opposed to, here's the 10 lessons you got to take your kids through.
Yeah, you can't read the Gospels and come out with an idea that Jesus had a curriculum book like the 14 of them I designed in the past.
Yeah, and so I think most people feel like, oh, well, I don't have the curriculum. If I only had the curriculum, then I could go through it. And it's like, no, then you'd have a form and you might end up with boredom.
French.
Yeah.
French classes.
French classes. But the reality is what we do in our kids' lives is we process life with them. We process their lives, and they get to see Daddy process Daddy's life.
I've noticed that with you guys, because we had dinner together last Friday night.
Yeah.
We had dinner with your family. We don't do that often enough, because we love
that. That was
it.
Fun.
And your kids were great. They were torturing me, but you got to say, I love that bit. Anyway, I love the fact that some of the things you're going through right now that are painful in your life, your kids know about.
Yeah.
And they just come up in conversation, very normal. And the way they pray for you, with you, care about you and Kelly, and wanted to know how I was doing with some similar things. I'm going, unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And they're young. They're not like, oh, massive mature. You just go like, they've learned how to process life. And it's not like I said, well, I got to learn to teach them how to process life. We just started living life. and stop the curriculum and the I got to manufacture these lessons.
We just
started attending to what's going on, and I don't know how to pretend something isn't going on.
We've got to get back to that God Journey book, because I tell you what, the biggest issue in the world for people is when they decide that systemed curriculum isn't working for me, still looking for another one. Still looking for something else to shape their life instead of this right here, which is what we wanted to talk about. How does God build a relationship with you in the reality of your life? Not what things do I need to know and rituals I need to incorporate and actions I should do to get God to like me, love me, bless me, work in me. It is, how do I recognize the God who's already in my life, what he's doing, that the curriculum of our life is really the situations we're facing today.
Yeah.
It's the jerk at work, you know, making fun of you, calling your names. That's the curriculum today. How does that
the
do
curriculum
my flesh?
Is how do I deal with that kid on the playground
Yes. Who
isn't behaving kindly towards me or any of my friends, and what do I do? What, Jesus, where are you in that mix? You know, do I just go into a prayer meeting and pray it through? Well, you know what? Sure, pray. But right at that playground, what do you do?
And what's going on in my heart?
Yeah.
And what's left-handed versus right-handed in dealing with those things? That's what makes this journey in Jesus thrive.
Yeah. I got the most beautiful gift from my kid last night.
What? It's not even Christmas.
Yeah, I got to tell you, is after a tough day of stuff I didn't want to deal with, Kelly hands me this, something that Jared's writing, because, you know, so he's got this entrance exam to go to this certain school, stuff like that, and it, you know, he's kind of trying to prepare and stress out, and he had to write an essay. So he wrote an essay, and it was, the topic was to pick, you know, someone who is your hero, and why. And I didn't see this coming at all. And I'm not trying to be my kid's hero.
Right.
I started reading.
So he didn't
this.
Write about me, I gather.
No. That'll be next week.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
He basically said that I was his hero. But the reason he listed why, it wasn't many and it wasn't achievement. He said, my dad is my hero because he's taught me how to forgive. And he listed some of the things.
Wow.
He listed some of the things he's watched me go through. And very poignantly and very clearly, he just said, I've watched my dad go through that and emerge with a clean, free heart. And that's why he's my hero. And you're just going like, wow. I mean, I sat there and tears welling up and just going like, my gosh, I had no idea.
It's not because you helped produce a national bestseller?
No.
Wasn't because you got a nice house in the pool for the kids?
No. And it's not because I
achieved.
There was no achievement in it. It was simply the ability to process hard things that he has translated into his own life.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And I sat there and I went, gosh. What an ultimate prize, because where did he even get the value to write that? I didn't shape that. That wasn't, you know, here's what's important in life, son. I mean, that didn't come from a conversation we had. That was something that you're just going like, in his own little world, he's processing what's going on, and he's looking at stuff. And it was just a gift back to me of just total perspective. I'm just going like, gosh, if there's anything that I can leave as a valuable legacy, it is the ability to help him learn to go through life. I can't protect him from it.
Right.
I can't put this bubble around him that will have an, you know, just a grace-free zone. I'm not going to even be remotely a flawless parent. I'm going to harm him in ways that I don't want to.
Yeah.
But if he has the power and the inspiration to say, you know what matters most, that I find heroic, is the ability to forgive. You look at the ultimate hero, Jesus on the cross. It doesn't get worse than that.
No, absolutely not.
The God of the universe coming to save his creation, them not recognizing, and we're going to put you to death. It doesn't, as far as bad days go, it doesn't get any worse than that.
No.
And the true heroism is forgiveness. I sat there and went, you know, I don't think the thought ever went through my head till it was fed back from my kid as boy. That's what he's picked up.
Isn't that the essence of, gosh, we're talking about this left-handed, right-handed power thing. Right-handed power thing says forgiveness will just get you walked on. It makes you a doormat. People will just exploit you and use you. And I guess Jesus' thing from the cross is, yeah, so what?
True.
I'm thinking about that today for stuff that we're going through. I'm going, true. Oh, my gosh, that...
True.
Yeah. Do you just, is that what it means about, you know, if your enemy asks you to go a mile, go two, if he hits you in the cheek, turn the other cheek. It really isn't about, there's no way to live, though. I guess I want to say, there's no way to live those things humanly. Because every one of those is an aspect of left-handed power instead of right-handed power. And the human thought is, I'll just get killed if I do that. And Jesus, again, probably would say, yeah, so what? Because he did.
Yeah.
But there's only life and relationship and wholeness inside the left-handed life that we share together in the Son. Once you resort to right-handed power, you burn the relationships and you burn...
It's no longer a nurturing environment
the work of the kingdom.
Gets celebrated. You can't, yeah. It just can't.
Wow. Wow. So I hope it's not that kind of a year.
Well, no.
No, that's good stuff.
I'm hearing perhaps some objections out there that it's like, yeah, but you know, is it just okay for criminals to be on the loose? No. God has made provision for law and government, and there are enforcers of that. It's just that the life of this kingdom, if it's going to be enjoyed and loved, I think you have an invitation to walk it left-handed.
Yep.
And you will live it left-handed. It's not to say that the use of right-handedness is wrong and evil. It's just that I think the true joy, you know, this is the kingdom of God. It's found in righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. There's a greater power when you don't have to exert your power to know that you haven't lost it.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus said, no one's taking my life, but I'm laying it down. And you're just going like, okay, that's a left-handed life.
Yeah, I first read some of this in Robert Farrar Campone's Kingdom, Grace, and Judgment, which is a great book on the parables. Even though I don't agree with all of his theology, and people are going to call me a heretic for even reading the guy, but he said some wonderful things about this. And at the beginning, he has a fascinating discussion of what he calls right-handed power, which is using the force you need to get the result you want. And yet the one who has all the right-handed power to force his way on us has decided that relationships of love are far more valuable to him than terrified slaves. He then defines right-handed power as power that looks for all the power that looks for all the world like weakness. But it's the power that Jesus vests his kingdom as the dying, rising, and disappearing Messiah. And yet he warns us that we will all prefer right-handed power. Every one of us would rather choose the right-handed logicalities of theology over the left-handed mysteries of faith. Any day of the week and twice on Sundays, often enough, we will labor with might and main to take the only thing that can save anyone and reduce it to a set of theological club rules designed to exclude almost everyone. Gosh.
It's in the living of this life and processing it. You can't prevent stuff from happening to you. You can't live in that fear of the illusion that you have the control over all of this. Like, how do you keep something from going sideways? You just simply don't have the power to do that.
Absolutely.
But we're never devoid of the supernatural grace of his power to respond.
Traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.